You turn on the TV and there's Hitler staring you straight in the face. The Nazis just keep cropping up. Pretty well every week, it seems, there's a documentary about Hitler that you can see.
In 1938, Adolf Hitler seized what legend said was history's most powerful weapon.
If you hold it, you're invincible.
It was said to be the spear which pierced the side of Christ.
Military leaders became almost besotted with the idea of possessing it.
And with the spear in his grasp, Hitler unleashed terror upon the world.
That's just one of the many documentaries about Hitler, so often screening on SBS. That one called Hitler and the Spear of Destiny. So, 70 years after the fall of the Third Reich, why do Nazis continue to hold such persistent interest? And not just in documentaries, but more generally in popular culture, in movies, memes, novels, even musicals. Sir Richard J. Evans is the author of The Third Reich in History and Memory. He's a former Regius Professor of History at Cambridge University. And later this morning, he's doing a talk at the Sydney Opera House, Why We Still Talk About the Nazis. So Richard joins us via Skype. Now, is it that we're still spooked by the degree of the evil and crimes committed in the name of National Socialism?
Well, I think we're more spooked than ever, in fact. There's quite an interesting development that's been going on. For example, the Holocaust, the mass extermination of European Jews, 6 million European Jews by the Nazis during the Second World War, has, I think, moved much closer to the mainstream of European and American culture in the last 20 years. We now think a lot more about it and write a lot more about it. There are more museums that are being opened up, Holocaust memorials, with the new capital of Germany after reunification in Berlin. There's a memorial to the Jewish victims of the Holocaust at the center of the capital. So I think it's become more prominent in European culture. And that, of course, puts Hitler right in the center of the picture because he was the man who ordered it and oversaw its implementation.
So if we go back to really the immediate post-war period, how then was Hitler and Nazism being understood differently from, as you've explained, the way we've shifted to now?
Well, I think in Europe, and particularly Britain and America as well, Nazism and Hitler were seen mainly as a force that had attempted European and then world conquest, though they didn't really get as far as expanding from Europe. But they were seen as a force that had invaded a whole swathe of European countries and subjugated them from Poland and Belarus, Ukraine and the Baltic lands in the east, Greece, and Italy in the south, and then, of course, France, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, Norway in the west, that attempted to conquer Britain, though without any success, thanks to the Royal Air Force and the Battle of Britain. So they're seen mainly as in terms of conquest, and really their war crimes, and there were, of course, massive there were hundreds of thousands of war crimes trials at the end of the war. We know about the famous one in Nuremberg, but there were many smaller ones of lesser Nazi criminals in many other countries. These focused very much on violations of the laws of war, so that the Holocaust was not at the center of the way in which people thought about the Nazis in the late 40s and early to mid 50s. And in Germany itself, of course, there was a real attempt to forget. People didn't want to know about this as a kind of collective amnesia while the Germans got on with trying to rebuild their country.
And I think you make the point too that countries like France that had been occupied, they were much more focused on the resistance and in Britain on their own stoicism than on Hitler and the Nazis.
Yes, that's right. In Britain, people celebrated the spirit of the Blitz, you know, the stiff upper lip while bombs are raining all round. And in France, the Republic was rebuilt, the Fourth Republic was built on a kind of myth that pretty well all French people had resisted the Nazis. And the whole embarrassing and difficult issue of collaboration, the Vichy government, the collaborationist government in the southern part of France, that was really pushed under the carpet.
On RN, this is Sunday Extra. Amanda Smith with you, along with the British historian Sir Richard Evans, whose special subject is why we're still talking about the Nazis. We're in a period now, Richard, where not very many people who served as Nazis during the Second World War are still alive, so prosecutions of people for war crimes are now quite rare. You know, that era is all but over. The crime that now has our attention is not around people but around objects, isn't it? Nazi-looted artwork.
Yes, I think that the fact that the perpetrators and indeed the victims are now very old or departing from the stage of history, as it were, has not made any real difference. In fact, I think we now focus more on the crimes of Nazism and the Holocaust, the destruction of European Jews, the concentration camps, and so on, than we did when all these people were still alive. I think history and historians have shown that we can actually deal with these subjects. But I think, as you say, there has been one big change since the fall of communism, and that is that we're now much more concerned with trying to restore stolen, particularly cultural objects, paintings and objets d'art and so on, to the Jewish, mostly Jewish owners and collectors from whom they were, who were dispossessed of them by the Nazis. And this kind of chain reaction went on, I think. When East Germany was incorporated to West Germany in 1990, there were more than 2 million claims for the restitution of property by West Germans, which mostly who'd emigrated to the West, which had been seized by the East German government. And that sparked then a whole another series of claims of compensation by Eastern Europeans, who for the first time were able to make these claims after the fall of their communist governments, for compensation for the fact that they'd been employed as slave laborers by the Nazis under terrible conditions. And that in turn, I think, sparked then a growing effort at restitution and compensation for looted art and spoliated art, to say art objects that were either just taken by the Nazis or were bought at knocked down prices in forced sales.
Now, you talk about the developing moral aspect, the more recent sort of moral aspect that we've taken to our approach to the history of Nazism and the Third Reich. Is, though, I mean, it just seems like Hitler is in a category on his own. I mean, there have been plenty of bad men in history, you know, just in the 20th century, Stalin, Pol Pot, Idi Amin. But it does seem like Hitler is still in a category of evil beyond anyone else that is going to keep him front and centre for a long time.
Yes, I think that's true, and it's interesting to think about why this is the case. I mean, in some parts of Eastern Europe and the Baltic states, I think this is probably not true. I think there's a real belief across that part of Europe that Stalin was as bad as Hitler, if not worse, and that the Second World War, in a sense, was a somewhat Pyrrhic victory because it delivered Eastern Europe and the Baltic states into the hands of Stalin and a communist rule for 40 years. But I think in America and Western Europe and most other parts of the world, Hitler does stand out as uniquely evil. And I think that's become more so since the end of the Cold War, when, of course, Stalin was held up as being just as bad as Hitler in most parts of the world. I think it's because you can kind of make a case, it's a bit of a limited one, but I make a case for Stalin. He did industrialize Russia, although it was an enormous cost. He did defend Russia against the Nazis. He did build Russia into something like a modern state. Also, I think it's pretty clear Stalin did not intend to conquer other parts of the world, that his military activities were just defensive. And to begin with, in fact, not very effective, but in the long run, he won and he beat the Nazis. But whereas Hitler, I think, stands out for two reasons, really. One is because he launched this massive genocide, not just against the Jews, that had a very special edge to it because he believed there's a Jewish world conspiracy to destroy Germany, but also he planned to exterminate between 30 and 40 million so-called Slavs, inhabitants of Eastern Europe, in his general plan for the East, which became official Nazi policy in 19, 1942. And it's important, I think, that Eastern Europeans remember that Stalin certainly did not liberate them, but he, quite the contrary, but he did rescue them from this genocidal plan. So the sheer scale of the genocide that that Hitler planned and in part carried out puts him in a class of his own. It's partly through his extreme racism and partly through his plans for, partly carried out plans for conquest, I think, that he stands out.
Yes, unambiguous evil. Fascinating to speak with you, Richard. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And Sir Richard J. Evans is speaking this morning on this subject at the Sydney Opera House in the studio. It's part of their Ideas at the House series, and it's at 11 o'clock. Hot foot it down there if you're in the vicinity. Richard's latest book is called The Third Reich in History and Memory. I'm Amanda Smith, and you're listening to Sunday Extra right here on RN.